We wrap up the deep dives, and now it's Brad's turn. We'll take a close look at how he's done this season on this Friday Locked On Celtics. Millie's, let's go! Rainy J's back with the vengeance back. All the real Celtics fans in attendance. This the truth like 34. This like walking in the garden when you hear the roars. The crowd goes crazy. Most in-depth coverage on the daily. Mainly podcast royalty, the content kings. When you talking about the franchise with 17 rings. Focus like Danny at the deadline. Global with it, got a local feel like the red line, the blue line, the green line. Play it in between time. I'ma throw my Siege jersey on in the meantime and press play. When the F's done, I can't wait until the next day. Trying to stay in tune with the Siege, that's the best way. Millie.
Friday here on the Locked On Celtics podcast. I want to thank you for sticking around all week. Excited for next week, starting on Tuesday. There will be a Monday podcast, but starting on Tuesday, we begin a very long series of diving into Celtics history. So starting Tuesday, we're going to go back to the beginning. Walter Brown hiring Red Auerbach, the beginnings of the Boston Celtics. And turn Locked On Celtics into a historical look at how this franchise was born, built, how it became a juggernaut, the 60s, the 70s, Tommy Heinsohn, Red Auerbach, everything, the whole thing. We're going from beginning to end starting next week. That's gonna carry us hopefully through most of this hiatus. For now, we're finishing off our deep dives of this season with a look at Brad Stevens, the coaching, the management of the team, and here to do that with me, Chuck McKinney of RedsArmy.com. Chuck, how's it going?
Wonderful, John.
Keeping your sanity?
Keeping my sanity. My evenings now consist of pouring an 8% alcohol IPA and watching Rambo Part 2 on AMC while I talk Celtics with you. So life, how much better could life be, right?
Look, this is exactly what high school senior Chuck probably envisioned his life being. Like, isn't this like the perfect Thursday night, sit around talking basketball, drinking beer, and watching Rambo?
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. You know, I'm just going to, for a half an hour, I'm going to forget about the madness, the chaos that's going on outside in the world, the death, all that stuff, and just kind of have a couple laughs, talk hoops, and power through for 30 minutes.
That's it. That's what this podcast is, and that's what this podcast will remain during the hopefully the entirety of this hiatus, and hopefully we can get through it. A little slice of sanity, a little departure, let's say, from reality.
I love that you're doing that historical deep dive next week and maybe the week after. And I love that you're going to have Red's Army's Mike Dinan come on and talk Celtics. There's no bigger Celtics fan than Mike. And another reason why I like Mike is that he's significantly older than I am, so I'm no longer the oldest Celtics fan around. So Mike is the OG, and he can run with that, and I can sit back and play the young guy.
There you go. Yeah, Mike's he's like a Celtics historian. He is a Celtics historian.
Oh, he's great.
And so, I mean, his Celtics fandom goes back to like the mid 60s. And so it's very easy to kind of like rely on him for some first person knowledge of what that entire era was. So, I mean, the beginnings of the Celtics, like the 50s, like even the BAA 1947 Boston Celtics, you know, that's obviously before anybody's time here, but we'll go through some really interesting stories about the beginnings. One of my favorite things is how the Celtics like twice tried to avoid getting Bob Cousy. Like that's one of the best things, because when you think of like
that's wild,
the Celtics, like, you just close your eyes and picture Celtics history. At least Bob Cousy is like one of the people that comes to the forefront, like it's Cousy, it's Russell, it's Bird. Like he's on the Celtics Mount Rushmore. And in the beginning, Red didn't want him, didn't draft him. And then they had a second opportunity, and they didn't want him then. And it was like the basketball gods forced it on the Celtics, which is a wild story that we'll get into starting next week. I love that stuff. So much of the beginning of Celtics history, Chuck, is so much luck. Like, it's like really like Red Auerbach. Red Auerbach was almost the head coach of Duke. And he could have been like the legend at Duke basketball. Like all of Red Auerbach's coaching genius could have been in college. And that's a story we'll get into, but like that's a stroke of luck. The freaking Ice Capades play into the role of getting Bill Russell. Like, it's so wild. The beginnings of this historical franchise. We could have been the Atlanta Hawks for all we know, if it wasn't for some breaks.
Yeah, that's nuts to think about. You're bringing up a lot of things that I wasn't, you know, really aware of, the whole Duke thing and the Cousy stuff. So I'm looking forward to listening next
week. Yeah, it's wild. The origins of a lot of this stuff are wild. Okay, let's wrap up our deep dives. And this is going to be an interesting podcast, I think, because I'm not even sure exactly where to go with some of this discussion with Brad Stevens. Not everybody, but a lot of us agree that Brad Stevens is a great, great coach, hell of a coach, one of the best coaches in the NBA. So it's hard for me to kind of like sit here and criticize a lot of what he does. But I thought that coming into this season, it was really interesting to see how he was going to respond after last season, where it was, you know, he admitted it. You could see the coaching job wasn't up to Brad Stevens' levels. Like, some of the things, I think the team really compromised on a lot of its principles. Danny, Brad, you know, other people in the front office and in coaching, to accommodate a guy like Kyrie Irving, who is the epitome of a star player that wants concessions, I think, for him. Like, he had his own trainer around. He did a lot of individual stuff. The Celtics didn't talk about it much, but you could see it at the beginning of training camp where the Celtics didn't allow individuals to work out. They always had them paired up, two, three, four guys together. They didn't want any players breaking off onto their own like last year. And it wasn't until you saw this year's reaction that you realized the contrast of last year. So it was really interesting to see Brad kind of lean into some of that real team heavy stuff early on at training camp.
Yeah. I mean, so that's the thing. And not to harp on last season, but that was really the switch with this Celtics team, right? Because previous teams under Brad's leadership were more of the up and coming, underdog,
yeah.
You know, just the scrappy, outwork you groups. They're right. Overachievers, right? And I think
just like the Butler teams that he had, like, yeah, that's his, right?
And you knew there was an obvious ceiling, but you still cheered them on when they made their way through the playoffs and such. So you get a sense that was, you know, Brad could handle that, and it was a completely different animal last year, because to win in the NBA, to win championships, you need those two kind of alphas. You need those superstar players who, like you said, are going to want things done their way. And the coach becomes, you know, it's a little bit of a shift. He has to kind of massage personalities while also leading and instructing and doing the X and O's thing. So the coach's role shifts as you get players like that. And last year was a complete disaster. We can just go out and say it. And I think Brad would probably say there were things he could have done better. So, so now here we are, and it's like, okay, you know, Kyrie's gone, but the Celtics were still kind of, expectations were still relatively high, right? With Tatum and Brown, and they brought in Kemba. So, I think it was, you know, there was a spotlight on Brad this year. So they go, well, what's he going to do? Because we saw what last year turned out to be. It was a failure. What's he going to do with this group? Can he handle this group? So there's some pressure on him, not to the point where we're necessarily worried about his tenure in the organization. But I think for the first time, it was like, Brad, show us something. Show us something that, you know, we know how you can lead the underachievers and get the best out of them. But now you're going to have a lot of talent. Now show us what you can do with top tier talent. Yeah. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, how do you think he's answered that challenge so far?
Well, it's different because the top tier talent that he has now is different. So what he doesn't have is the petulant guy on the team, you know? So, what made Phil Jackson, Phil Jackson, was his ability to take combustible type personalities and make them work together. You know, you take Kobe and Shaq and you make them work together, maybe for a year or two longer than it would have otherwise. Or maybe you make it work together when other coaches wouldn't even have that level of success. So Stevens didn't have quite that big a challenge last year, but Kyrie is definitely in that mold. He's not an easy person to connect with. He's not an easy person that, you know, you don't know what you're getting sometimes from day to day. So that challenge was there, and the challenge clearly was failed. This year, what challenge does he have? Your stars are Kemba Walker, who is maybe one of the nicest people in the NBA. I mean, that guy's always happy and positive. Yeah. He's got Gordon Hayward, who he coached in college, and two homegrown guys in Tatum and Brown that he's coached from 19 years old and who are in their third and fourth years and making these leaps and are still young guys that are listening to their coach and have only just started to like see the real scope of their powers. So he doesn't have that attitude here that he has to deal with. So whatever success these Celtics have, be it this year if they resume or next year, there's always going to be that thing until Brad Stevens gets those guys again. Like until 7 years from now, 8 years, whatever it is, that the Celtics are back in rebuilding mode and they sign the star of the day and he's, you know, known for being a little bit difficult. That's the next time, like whenever that happens again, people are going to be like, okay, let's see what Brad does, because right now he's back to scrappy team. But his scrappy team also has a lot of talent on it because these guys have taken big steps forward and Kemba's Kemba. So,
yeah. So there's definitely a unique challenge where we've seen Tatum and Brown really kind of explode this year. So it's, not a true kind of underachieving team. So there are expectations that have surfaced in the midst of this season, that we quite maybe didn't have early on. We've seen how good this team can be. We've seen Tatum explode. And I think that's why fans have recognized that. And I think that's why you started to see some fans become more critical of Brad than in years past. Right? I felt that. I'm sure you see it.
Oh, sure. Sure. In fact, there's one aspect to his personality that I think fuels that. I'm going to tell you what I think that is right after this break. Next on the Locked On Celtics podcast.
You are Locked On Celtics, your daily Boston Celtics podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Brad Stevens is an interesting guy, and he's analytical, I'll say. He sees the basketball season as – he doesn't see games as individual games. I think the biggest thing – I wrote about this, and I said this once on a podcast. Celtics, NBA people, they don't see the games like
you or I tend to, which is each game is its own story, beginning, middle, end of story. And then we analyze the story. It's like watching a show or something like, but he and people in the NBA see the season as the story and each game as a chapter in that book. And so they don't, when we react to certain things in games, may overreact to certain things in games even, we're reacting because we are so focused on that one thing. Whereas they're just like, well, you know, it's just part of it. This is part of it. And we've got more to go. And each chapter is being written as it goes, but they see everything as a bigger picture. But I think for Brad Stevens, if there is a weakness that I see in his coaching, I think that he is a little too tied to some of the things like, I don't know, the minutes, the rotations, the experimentation a little bit, where there's an opportunity to break from it individually in certain games and go for a win in certain spots. I think he passes up on those opportunities and he kind of sticks to his plan a little too closely, doesn't deviate from that. And I think the last game that they played in Indianapolis, I kind of asked them about that. They had a lead. It was like a 12-point lead, a 14-point lead, and they had survived with like Cantor and Shemmy and maybe Wanamaker on the floor, and they made a little bit of a run. They were up 14-16. Indy called a timeout and brought their starters back out. Brad sent those guys back out, not his starters. And I was like, huh. In my mind, as I'm watching the game, I think I was talking to Adam Himmelsbach. I was like, okay, they survived. I can't believe they survived this long with Cantor, who'd been bad for a stretch. All right, this is their opportunity to go in, close this thing out, and put Tatum in, put Brown. Was Brown playing? Well, whatever. Put your starters back in, finish this thing off, boom, done. But you know that Indy made a run. They made it close. Boston won, but it was a lot closer than they thought it was going to be. I think that's where Brad Stevens misses an opportunity to steal a couple of wins, to deviate from his plan, and go for wins in individual games in like November and December.
Yeah, I think you're 100% correct there. You know, as far as the perspective thing, yeah, it's a complete, you know, it's the complete opposite of, you know, how I look at games.
Right.
Right. I'm in the moment. Let's win the games. And I understand that perspective. But I also look as, you know, I think while the season is long, I feel like there are far too many instances at the end of the season when you can look back and say, oh man, we were only, you know, two games behind Toronto. We could have had home court. And I think if we only put a little bit more effort into some of those games, or maybe not effort, but more strategic thinking in the moment, mm-hmm. then maybe we could have flipped a couple games and achieved home court. So I, you know, and that's what drives me nuts as a fan, because I, you know, tend to put a lot of stock in the home court in the playoffs. Mm-hmm. And it sometimes doesn't seem like they do as much, or at least not publicly, or they want to execute their long game more than the short game, at the expense of a home court. So that's what drives me nuts about that sort of thinking. But you know, as you talked about, you know, what Brad does in game, do you think, like, so he gets a lot of heat for not calling timeouts,
right?
Whether it's to stop runs, to kind of when he should kind of reset the team or call a certain play when it's a critical, you know, point of the game with under 2 minutes. And do you think that also falls under that line of thinking where he's more like, well, here's a good situation where I want the guys to figure it out themselves, or here, you know, I feel like if I call the play from the sideline, I want to see how they react to it. So it's more so a teaching moment or something like that than what's best for in that particular game.
Well, it's funny that you asked that, because as you were talking, I was going to transition to making that exact point. Now, I literally was thinking that entire, like, the timeouts fall under this umbrella. And look, this is just my opinion. He, you know, when I asked him the question in Indy, he's like, well, we got to rest these guys sometime. And he's right. Like, we're also in a point where there are certain minutes that they want guys to play. And yeah, you can go and have this guy play, pick a guy, whatever, play 36 in this one game instead of 33. But again, they see the big full picture and they say, well, that 36, you say, well, it's just three more minutes. Well, yeah, but that's three more minutes of running and jumping on joints. You don't know, like, they have data, they have information that says what the optimal thing for them to do is, understanding that eventually going to ramp up and make the big run for the playoffs. Timeouts are the same thing. Like, I sit there and say, well, yes, I agree with exactly the point you made, Chuck. There are times where I think he should call a timeout, settle his team down, stop a run, and really just reset things. But I think in regular season games, he says what you said. I want these guys to figure it out, because, and it makes sense, because you say, look, if it means giving up a 10-point lead or a 15-point lead now in order to learn lessons, gather information, show it to them on film, and say, this is what you need to do in this situation, that is worth the whatever your stress you're going through in that moment in November, December, January, if that lesson can be applied in April, May, and June. Mm. And so that I completely agree with that line of thinking, but also at the same time, there has to be some consideration, in my opinion, that, you know what, sometimes it's just, you got to settle guys down and get them, like, it's all like a slap across the face and be like, all right, get your asses in gear. Let's get back to it. Remind them of the things they need to do and get them back out there. But that's, I mean, we've been saying this for a few years, and I don't know that that's going to be who he is as a regular season coach. I think in the playoffs, he's less likely to do that.
Yeah.
It's hard to sit there and be like, well, this is an absolute thing you're doing wrong, because the mentality behind it is sound. I think, like, if he can get these guys to learn their lesson, the problem is, I think he always expects these guys to learn their lesson. And I think that's part of what last year was. Like, he always expects these guys to kind of get through it. And sometimes the Brad Stevens kind of motivational book reader, Brad Stevens, sometimes that type of stuff that he kind of espouses doesn't resonate with some of these guys. And some of these guys just need to, you know, be MF'd to death. And like, you know, that's how you get through to some guys. So, but also I'm not in film sessions. I'm not on the court with them. You know, I don't know exactly how, what he's doing behind closed doors, which is part of what makes the assessment of Brad Stevens as a coach a little difficult.
Yeah. I mean, I'll just boil it down to this. I support Brad's decisions when they work, and when they don't, I'm here to second guess them. That's just how it is, right?
That's how it goes. That's it. It's funny. Let's pause for a second, because it's interesting to see how he's growing, and what he's going to become as he continues to grow as a coach in the NBA. Let's do that in a minute. Follow us on our social channels at LO Celtics on Twitter and at Locked On Celtics on Instagram. So one thing I've noticed about Brad Stevens is his kind of loosening up with, at least with the media. Whereas, you know, in the beginning, he was very seemingly guarded, straightforward. As the years have gone on, he's loosened up more and more and more, jokes a little bit more, said, you know, is a little bit more of a willing to take not shots at his players, but, you know, be a little more, I don't know. I'll say call him out a little bit, but not to a degree, not like Greg Popovich. But he slowly, when you consider where he was and where he is now, he's closer to Greg Popovich than he was when he started as a coach.
Yeah, I mean, I see it more prominently with the officiating in the games, and
oh, yeah.
I think we'll see clips where he's dropping F-bombs now or expletives, and they're and he might joke about it afterwards, but he seems more animated now. And even just, you know, from the things we can glean through his direct conversation with the officials, I don't know. To me, it seems much more obvious that he's challenging officials more aggressively. And I'm not saying that's leading to like more technical fouls. It just seems like he's more outwardly assertive in challenging calls and such. So maybe that ties into what you're saying. There's just some level of comfort as he progresses. I still think, you know, to speak of, to touch on what you said, he still seems very protective of his players to me.
Yeah.
And he'll make general comments about whether it's certain groups, who failed in stretches of games. He won't pull back when he says that, if he's saying the team isn't aggressive or they didn't defend or were sloppy with the ball, he will rip them apart collectively.
Right.
But if there's ever a player or two who were the obvious sort of scapegoats, Brad just, he's protective, you know, and I don't expect any sort of coach to really come out and hammer a guy, but I think you can see him thinking through answers when he's asked particular questions on, you know, how he's going to shape his answer to kind of make it more of a kind of spread the blame around. If it seems like one person may be more responsible than others, he will spread it around, point to other areas of the game that were equal failures. Or sometimes he'll just, you know, divert to it being, you know, you learn. Sometimes he'll just flat out say, you know, we still have young guys and they're still learning. They're still growing pains, right? Mm-hmm. So that's how I see him. You know, I think he's still a bit protective of his players. But it's not at the point where I say that's negative, because like you said, you don't know what's happening behind closed doors in those film sessions. I'm just not sure if that's his demeanor to – you know, call out anyone publicly. And I think, you know, he's probably we saw what it did to this team last year, not when he did it, but when Kyrie was calling out, you know, groups of players. It's not helpful. So right. I think he's, you know, maybe he's also learning on how to keep everything in even keel somewhat.
Yeah. I mean, he's definitely the rudder for this team. Like I think he's a good counterbalance. Like, he's very much in the not too high, not too low type of. So if a player is getting too much praise, he'll pull back on that. So if we're in there being like Jason Tatum, wow, he's so awesome, he's so great, Brad will either say, yeah, but Jaylen Brown was also very good in this and other. That's where he'll start to like spread the praise around, like, so, and that's happened plenty of times. Or one time, I forget which game it was, where Tatum had a big scoring game and I asked about his defense. Brad really loved to answer that question, because the defense, like, that's something that, you know, people want to get a lot of praise for guys on on offense, but Brad's a defensive guy first. And so if you ever like ask a question about some guys playing good defense, he's really going to want to pump a guy up for that. So he'll deflect. And if everybody sucked, like except for the Brooklyn game, which is like the first time he's ever been like, yeah, we sucked out there. That was embarrassing. Other than that, he'll focus on like positive things, or he'll say his favorite phrase this year, I think, has been, that's just part of it. And he's going to make sure, like internally, I'm sure he's ripping these guys. I'm sure internally that he's not like super aw shucks guy. Like he's really one of the more eye-opening days that I've had on this job was in Phoenix, where they actually sat me courtside at the scorer's table. And I was very close to, like, Brad was constantly in front of me, like blocking my view. And you hear how he interacts with the refs and how he interacts with players and the little things that he says and when he says something and not says something. Like it was, you know, he'll tell guys like, hey, that wasn't a good shot, or, you know, what are you doing? You got to be out. Mm-hmm. You're like, he's talking to them a lot more than you would see watching the game on television. But when it comes to the media, he has very publicly stated too much praise is basically not great. It's not good for a player to hear too much praise. It's not good for a player to hear too much criticism. You kind of want it to be in the middle. So whenever either one of those things is overwhelmingly happening, he'll go the other way with it.
Yeah, that's a good point. And you know, you talked about him praising Tatum's defense. Brad, he needs credit for being a great defensive coach.
Yes,
right. I think it maybe in years past the Celtics have had some defensive teams that were good. I think Horford got a lot of the credit there. But this year, seeing, you know, what our expectations when Al left, and we did not expect defense to be their strong suit, and just seeing Tatum blossom, I want to give Brad a lot of credit for that, and I want to give him a lot of credit for the team's defensive success. That clearly has to be one of his strengths, and I don't think people think of him that way. Sometimes you have coaches who, for whatever reason, get some sort of reputation, whether they're a player's coach or they're a hothead or they're an offensive genius or something. But and I think Brad's always just kind of fallen in the middle. But I think he deserves a lot of credit as being a really good defensive coach.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's now, this is like the first year where you really have that as like his reputation. Like, and you go back. So this year, they're fourth. Last year, they were seventh. The year before, first. Wow. The best defense in the NBA, 2017-18. The year before that, let's see, 2016-17, they were 13th. And that was the year, let's see, yeah, hard to have a good defensive team. That was Jaylen Brown's rookie year. So I think that was the lowest it's been. Let me see. 15-16, that was Brad Stevens' second year as a coach. They were fourth, and his first year as a coach, they were 12th. So only twice were they ever outside the top 10, and the lowest it's ever been is 13th. That's impressive.
That's remarkable. I mean, I know
the teams that he's had.
Yeah, I mean, he's coached some stud defensive players, Marcus and Horford, and I think we're seeing, you know, Jalen's talents and now Tatum's, but he deserves a lot of the credit for bringing it all together, because some of those teams were a little lean.
Yeah, actually, I'm wrong. There was one more. There's his actual first season where they were just that was the horrible season.
Awful.
That was his 25-57. They were 18th. That was the lowest ranked. So, but that was the year where they had like 20 guys on the team. Danny Ainge made like 8 trades. It felt like they started that year with Rondo on the team. I believe, was that the year that they had Rondo?
Is it the previous year? Or they traded Rondo beforehand. They had Vitor Favorani on that team. Marshawn Brooks was on that team. Keith Bogans was still on the roster at that point. So,
yeah, good luck. Good luck getting defense out of that group.
Yeah. So, yeah. So they did that. That was the year that they had Rondo at the beginning, and they traded him at like Christmas. So that was that. There was just never going to be that. That team was always going to be bad. But yeah, it is impressive, and the way that he's adjusted this year, the defense, like from being able to funnel, like last year they played two bigs and they played their defense a certain way. And this year they've only got the one big, and they're doing different things. They're using different techniques on pick and rolls. They're switching a lot more. They're changing how they switch, which is an interesting concept that it's hard for the casual fan to see, and really had to be explained to me a little bit. But Brad and I actually had a conversation off to the side one day. And basically he was like, you know, you can't just switch like the same way all the time, because you can anticipate that. You have to like change up how you switch. You have to change up like when in the play that you switch.
Yeah.
You know, like you have to make it seem like we're not switching, and then you do. And it's like, it's the level of intricacy that he has employed in that stuff is really, really remarkable. And he's been willing to throw in more zone. He has a different defensive scheme when Enes Kanter is on the floor, which is by necessity. Mm-hmm. But you know, he has like different things, different techniques, and it just continues to work. Of course, obviously, Chuck, defense is all about the effort that's being played with on the floor.
Of course.
So, you know, that's part of it. Like you have guys that are willing to do these things, and he's been lucky to have like Marcus Smart, who's going to like lead by example. But he's got other guys come in, like even Kyrie, who wasn't a good defensive player necessarily. When he was engaged and he was doing the things that Brad wanted him to do, he was a better than expected defensive player.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, Kemba is, you know, his defense might have been a little underrated, but it was never really great. But he's out there doing a lot of the things that, you know, so he gets guys to buy in at that end.
So you're telling me that there's more to switching than just like the playground technique of when I would blurt out switch in a moment where I felt it was beneficial to me as an individual.
Yes.
And my teammate wasn't necessarily ready for it, but I was in a good position to switch. So I did. There's more to it than that.
There's a smidge more than the, oh shit, I'm beat switch.
The oh shit, I'm beat switch. That was my calling card.
That was
my calling card.
Yeah. That's why the guy who's defending the player doesn't call out the switch. It's the guy who will switch onto him who calls out the switch. It's we always sit there and be like, because I would be the same way. Like, oh shit, I'm toast. You know,
right.
Switch. I'll go get your guy. This is the only way we're gonna stop this play. But it's usually the other guy that would be coming over that calls out the switch. But it really is. It's fascinating. Like, I could spend all day sitting like in that film room trying to learn what Brad Stevens is teaching these guys. I don't know if I could pick up a fraction of it. and anytime, what's funny is, anytime I do figure out a little bit of it and I ask Brad about it, he's like, "Nah, I'm not going to tell you anything about that." Like, I'm not going to, like, I asked him a specific question. He's like, "You can go watch the film and try to figure that out, because I'm not telling you." Like, he guards like state secrets that, you know, if you're able to catch on, and look, everybody catches on. Like, if I do like stumble onto something and write about it, he might be a little bit pissed, but all the advanced scouts that are there have already figured it out.
Of course.
You know, like I sit next to, you know, what's funny. Kevin Gamble is a scout for, I think, the Toronto Raptors now.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow, what a blast from the past there,
right,
huh?
Right. I see him on the road more than I see, like, maybe anybody else. I've sat next to Kevin Gamble probably at, like, six different arenas at this point. And it's hilarious. And the last time coming back from Indy, I didn't see him. He was sitting in a different spot, but I bump into him in the airport. So Kevin Gamble probably knows everything that the Celtics are doing, you know, and the Celtics advanced scouts probably know everything that the Raptors are doing. And so, but Brad's still like, you know, he's not going to make it easy for us to give away any of his playbook.
No. And, you know, to that point, right. So, Danny knows what Brad wants to do. There may be some sort of team defense philosophy. So Danny's maybe trying to bring in players, or they're drafting players who they think can fit best with, you know, on both ends of the floor. I mean, I think we've seen a little bit of what Langford can do, on both ends. Right. But, you know, they're for the most part, Danny's going to bring in guys right. who he thinks can fit in with, you know, all the schemes that Brad's going to run. And there has to be synergy there, right? And
I think absolutely.
There's no doubt in my mind that those two work well together.
Yes, that's true. I mean, they really do have a good rapport together. I mean, Danny be the first person, like, how many times have questions about Brad come up and he'll just immediately shoot back, well, Brad's not he's the least of our problems.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So like it's they do work well together. And I think, they respect each other. Like Danny really respects, Brad's mind. And you can see, like, you know, giving him certain types of players that in the draft that, you know, you would think could fit into what he does, you know, the rangy wing that's switchable. I mean, that's Romeo Langford, right? Like he's in that mold. Like, how many wings do you need? But in today's NBA, like, they're both on board with what today's NBA is. And I think that's part of why they work so well together. Like, you don't have one guy going, ah, come on, you know, I need a big, I need a guy in the post, and another guy go, we're positionless, and your tallest guy's going to be 6'8". Like, you right. don't have that butting of heads, so that's what you get. So when certain guys were on the board, they still let certain guys go so they could draft Langford, you know, rather than, you know, Brandon Clark or right. some of the other names that were out there. And it doesn't always work out, but like that's, you can see how they work together in those decisions.
Yeah. And, you know, oftentimes you watch a Celtics game on national TV and, the smart analyst will say it's Boston's versatility on defense, and the ability to switch. And they just have this type, which is the Tatum and the Brown, and Langford kind of fits into that. Just these long, flexible, switchable, wing players. So, it's really working. I mean, we just touted the defensive success that they have. So it's definitely working. And
yep.
I'll defer to them. I made the moment be critical when an offensive rebound doesn't go our way, or when we're getting our shit blocked in the paint, you know, by a dominant big, but more often than not, Danny and Brad, I'll concede, know more than I do.
That's very big of you. I'm glad we could end the podcast on that admission. In conclusion, Brad is very good at his job. But it'd be interesting to see if he does loosen up on some of the things. Like, he's the focus on the data gathering. I wonder if, and look, also, there has been so much change over the course of time with him. How many different teams has he had? Like, I'm really curious if moving forward, if most of these guys stay the same, is there going to be a need to gather data for as long? You know, so part of Brad's evolution as a coach depends on the construction of the team. And coaches are a function of the players in the NBA. So If he has a little bit more continuity moving forward, then he can, you know, he can lean on those guys, you know, like Pop leaned on Tim Duncan. Part of what made Pop pop is that Tim Duncan was fully on board and he could be himself. And, yeah. You know, like, is Tatum going to be, I don't want to say be the Tim Duncan because, like, I don't, Tim Duncan's a legend. I mean, I don't know if he's ever going to be that good, but can he be the star that's bought in and can let Brad kind of even, you know, grow some more? So, I mean, we'll see in the future if that can be the case. But I think the continuity moving forward is something that would play into who Brad becomes as a coach.
Yeah, and I'm hopeful, right? We're starting to see pieces that hopefully are here for a decent amount of time. But that's what's, you know, crazy about the NBA is that you can never really predict what disgruntled star is going to become available, what the scenario is, what GM is going to swoop in and make right. that gutsy move. So we think we're ready for the Tatum, Brown, Kemba sort of era for the next handful of years. But with Danny, you know, and the way the NBA and the landscape is always changing, you never really know.
Right. Right. And, you know, Danny, as much as he gets crap for like not making certain deals, he's always ready to make one. So you never, like you said, you never know what's going to come along to shake things up, but we'll see what the future holds. Hopefully it holds actual basketball some point in the next few months. And so subscribe here to the Lockdown Celtics podcast to hear about whatever's going to happen. And again, next week, starting Tuesday, we're basically going to go 4 days a week on the historical stuff and leave Monday open for like mailbags and stuff as a wild card day. So 4 days a week for the foreseeable future. And the schedule is always, you know, maybe we will have to shift it to 5 days depending on how things go. But the historical deep dive into the Boston Celtics. So next week we start at the beginning, the birth of the Boston Celtics. So you got to make sure you're subscribed to the podcast for that. All the great written reviews and 5-star ratings have been very helpful. Keep those coming. And be sure next week to check out the new podcast, Chad Ford's Big Board. Chad Ford joining the Locked On Network to bring you his draft analysis, top-notch draft analysis. So that's it. Thanks for listening. This has been the Locked On Celtics podcast. We're part of the Locked On Podcast Network.